Okay, if it's okay with you, I think I'll do this without the microphone, which doesn't seem to have working batteries anyway, so. And thank you for coming closer so you can hear me. We're going to be very informal. If you need to leave, leave. If you want to take a nap, whatever's better for you. And we'll stay as long as people have questions or we have anything to talk about. So where do you want to start? You want to start with your questions? Maybe that's the best place. Then I have some exercises that are, I think most of them are the ones that were on the web anyway, but we'll walk through them and see if we can apply Bronfenbrenner to interpreting some of the stories that I brought with me. Yep. So, questions about the exam itself or anything? Wide open.
Not format-wise, but concept-wise, dealing with molar activities.
Mm-hmm.
Is it more individual-based? I mean, interpretation of the meaning, if it has intent for that specific individual, I mean, a molar activity for one person might not be a molar activity for another person.
Right. Yeah, good point. The question is whether the molar activity is from the perspective of the person who is engaged in the activity. And the question underlying that is, could something be a molar activity to the person doing it and not a molar activity for somebody else? And yes, that would be possible. And the reason it could be possible is that the molar activity has its intent and its momentum through the person who's engaged in it. And if that person doesn't see the intent and doesn't have any intention in doing it, is just thinking about it or not thinking about it, then it's probably not molar. But it may be an activity that might be molar for that person, but which would not be for somebody else because somebody else would already have mastered that one and gone beyond it. So the critical question is, what is happening for the person who's engaged in the activity? If that person has intent and the activity has momentum for that person, then it's a molar activity for that person. And that means we have to be careful. It's a nice example, it's a nice question, because it reinforces the notion for Bronfenbrenner that we have to be careful to be thinking about the ecosystem and its components from the perspective of the person whose life we're looking at. So I might look at an activity and see it as that somebody else is doing and see it as pretty useless and irrelevant and not worth anything. So I might not call it molar because I'm not understanding its importance in and to the person who's engaged in it. And the critical question is, what is it doing for that person? What is the intent? And I'm struck then by situations where adults or teachers don't think that something a kid is doing is particularly important, so they discount it and some maybe even punish the kid for engaging in it. But it may be very important behavior for the child. It may be something the child is really working on, but the teacher or the parent doesn't appreciate what it's doing for the child's development.
Is the momentum based on the importance of the activity? The momentum, the desire to complete what is going on?
Is the momentum based on the desire to complete it and to engage in it? Yeah, that's really what the momentum is. That the person wants to continue it, wants to complete it, wants to explore it, to elaborate it, to take it farther. And that's motivation that has to come from within the individual who's engaged in the activity. So it means that if we try to interrupt the activity, or if the person is prevented from continuing it, the person will be annoyed, irritated with it. Did that go far enough? Okay. Good. Thank you. Yes. I'm sorry, I need to go back to the beginning.
People who are in your first order network become your second order network if those settings are dropped from the message system, and if there's a primary link within
Okay, so as I understand the question is, can a person who's in your first order network, somebody that you share settings with, move from that status to the second order network if that person stops being a transcontextual dyadic person with you? Do you have an example in mind? Right. So the situation, again, if I understand it, is you lived with somebody, and then that person moves to another setting, but you still associate with people who are in that setting that the person moved to. Am I confusing it? Okay, you live with your sister.
And I have friends over here.
And you have friends in another setting.
Right, which I go to. But
and you go to, but she doesn't.
But she doesn't. And then I stop going there, but she goes there.
Yeah, and then you switch places. So she starts going there.
So, and they originally would be in her second order network, because she doesn't see them face to face.
Okay.
But it doesn't matter if I have previously been in her
Right. So what has happened to those people in your ecosystem is that they were in your first order network because you went to visit them, but now you don't visit them anymore, so they're not in your first order network. They're not people you share settings with. And they were in your sister's second order network because she didn't go there, and now she does. So they're in her first order network because she shares a setting with them, and they have moved to your second order network.
Right.
So it's a question about shift in the relationship or their place in your ecosystem. And it's a nice illustration of people moving from people that you're with, that you visit, that you share settings with, and then don't. So their role in your life changes. But over time, as their role in your ecosystem changes, the ability to maintain and to understand what's going on in the second order network, that's now an exosystem setting for you, their residence, and now where your sister goes, your ability to understand and perhaps use that second order network or benefit from it is enhanced by the fact that those people actually used to be in your first order network. So they're people you know. And when you communicate with your sister about them, you can put what she says about them into a developmental context because you have known them in the past. So she may be describing some way they have changed, and you actually have better intersetting knowledge of what's going on there because you have had them in your first order network. Okay? It's a nice example, and it's something that Bronfenbrenner doesn't really focus on, but as you think about changes in your ecosystem over time, excuse me, as you think about those changes, one of the important things that's happening is that people are becoming closer connected, more closely connected in your ecosystem, or more distant in your ecosystem. And that helps us understand our relationships with those people. And people may move in and out of your life over a long period of time, and that second order network is important because it's how we keep connection with people that, it's one of the ways we keep connection with people who have been important in our lives. And it may represent a change for the negative in a relationship. For example, a more dramatic one that some of you have been through is you may have lived with a parent, and then your parents separate, and one of them moves into a different setting into which you don't go. And maybe there's enough negativity that you don't go there and the other parent doesn't come, so you don't share any settings with that parent. That's a huge change in the family system, to not share any setting with a person that you've shared a setting with intimately up to the point of separation. And for many kids, when their parents separate, that happens. One of the parents becomes, at least temporarily, and sometimes it's a fairly long period of time, no longer a member of the first order network. But perhaps a second order network, I can remember a specific situation where because of animosity between the parent and the teenager in this particular case, the teenager refused to have contact with the father, but the younger siblings continued to, and they would go to the father's apartment and spend time there and then come home, and so it created a second order network relationship with the father. But that's quite a demotion in the importance in your ecosystem, and it means that there are things that aren't going to happen with the parent and the child if they're not sharing settings. There are then no joint activities. And probably the affect is going to be affected by that. The reciprocity is shot. The power may be up for grabs. And it's helpful for us to understand why a kid is having difficulty or why the parent is having difficulty or both, to understand that this has been a major change in the ecosystem. As the parent has moved out of the mesosystem and his or her setting becomes an exosystem setting. And that's a major hassle. It's a hassle that parents complain about constantly, that they no longer have direct contact and joint activities and molar activities that get more complex with their children, so they feel their involvement in their children's development slipping away. On a practical note, what that means is you can use your understanding of Bronfenbrenner to say, okay, if I'm not going to participate in the setting with that parent, how can the parent maintain any kind of relationship with the child? And one of the questions that we often get is, how do I maintain a relationship with my child if I'm out of the country, or if I'm out of state, or if I'm forbidden to see my child, or the kid doesn't want to see me? How do I do that? And it's not just divorced parents, it's soldiers abroad, people who are traveling. How do you maintain some kind of developmental presence in the child's life as you do that? And there are lots of techniques, using the mail, using the technology, using email, using the internet, using your iPod to maintain some contact. Then the task is, how can you figure out a way to engage in a joint activity that becomes more complex? So parents do interesting things like keeping an electronic journal where they write and the child writes back, and they keep this jointly. Sometimes parents will write a story with the child, so the story grows. Some parents with older kids will play electronic chess or internet chess with them. Used to be postcard chess. So they'll engage in activities that keep them in a primary dyad and potentially a developmental dyad, but they have to use the second order network to do that, and they have to use the technology because they don't share settings with each other. Okay, thank you. That was a nice question. Other? Yes?
What if you are like really good friends with someone and then like you stop talking to them but they're still in your setting? Are they considered to be a second order network?
No, not if they're in the setting. Okay, the question is if you're good friends with somebody and then you stop talking to them, or they stop talking to you. I mean, it's her fault. And but you're still in the same setting. This is called the silent treatment among roommates. You are sharing a microsystem, and it's still first-order network then because this person is in the same setting and share it. Even though you don't communicate, the reciprocity is very poor. Joint activities are not very developmentally helpful. The affect is negative. And then you have the War of the Roses. You know, parents who are sharing a house but don't talk to each other because they refuse to give up. There's another movie about that, too. But many people engage in the silent treatment. Couples do that. What was the... Oh, Little Miss Sunshine. Right? The kid, the teenager was in the house, but he hadn't talked for how long? Months and months. He hadn't said anything to anybody. But he's still there. And the interesting thing about people's influence on your development is that the person who's engaging in such behavior, such as not talking, becomes very important in the microsystem. And it's actually a way sometimes to get a great deal of power because you really run the show if you're not engaging in the typical behaviors. And everybody's walking on eggshells or they're focused on you rather than anything else. Your behavior becomes a major molar activity for you and everybody else engages it in order to try to change you or to make things better. So we see this with kids with disabilities. We see this in having a family member who has an emotional illness, a psychiatric illness. Their inability or refusal, whichever it is, to participate in the typical kinds of microsystem pattern changes the microsystem and everybody's affect and makes them a focus in the household. And that's a very important change that takes place in some families. A more benign and happy way of doing that is to have a baby. Yeah. Babies come in and they don't do the normal sorts of things. They do normal baby things. But everybody gets focused on them and it changes the entire microsystem pattern. Other, yes.
How do you distinguish the concept of power and the process of power? How are they different from each other? I feel like power is a cover, but I feel like there's a process.
Yeah, the question is how you distinguish power and reciprocity. And they seem to be dependent on each other, interdependent. And that's true. They are interdependent in the same way that affect is often interdependent with them. So the three concepts within the dyad, the power, the affect, and the reciprocity, are not independent of each other. But they focus on different, each element focuses on a different aspect of the transaction. The affect focuses on the feeling for each person, sort of the emotional tone. The power refers to the ability to influence what happens in the dyad. and to influence the activities that you engage in and the pattern of those activities. So you have the power if you're the one who is driving the relationship, the dyadic relationship, if it is responding to you and the other person is doing what you want, catering to you, then you have the power. And that would typically involve at the same time lower reciprocity. The reciprocity refers to the give and take in the relationship, and as the reciprocity gets higher, it's likely to mean that the power is more balanced. But not necessarily. The reciprocity can be fairly high while one person has all the power, or a large part of the power. You can take turns doing things, and doing the chores, doing the dishes, doing the cooking, listening to each other, and that would be potentially a high level of reciprocity, but the schedule might be determined by one person. The activities might be chosen by one person. So you're following, and you're doing the reciprocity because you're taking roles and you're giving and taking in it, but the decisions and the influence are still in the hands of one of the people instead of sharing that too. So that you know, helps, I think, a little bit to think about reciprocity as the activities and power focusing on the influence of which activities are done, and in fact whether there is reciprocity may be a function of how much power or how you use your power. Okay. And it is, I just want to reinforce, it is a subtle and not very clear distinction. But when I look at a microsystem, or I look at a couple or a dyadic relationship, I try to separate who's making the decisions and how much give and take is there, or alternation in the activities that they're doing. A practical example that comes to mind is the one on chores in the household. Some of you live in situations where everybody does chores on a rotating basis. You have the list on the refrigerator, but there's one person who in the first place decided that was the way you were going to do it because she didn't like the mess and the lack of a schedule. So she came in and said, okay, this is the way we're going to do it. And everybody said, okay, fine. So there's a fair amount of reciprocity within that part of the relationship in the system. But one person is the one who makes sure that people do their task and makes up the schedule.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't that also
mean power decline for the other person in the relationship, which is detrimental to their development? Yeah, good. Perfect relationship is like taking perfect balance and power, so no one gets hurt anymore. Right. The question is about the change in the direction of power or the balance of power in a relationship that's beneficial, according to Bronfenbrenner, for the developing person. And it's important that he's focusing on the developing person. He says that the relationship is good for that person if there's more power going toward that person within the relationship. And the observation is that means that for the other person, the power is declining. And wouldn't that be bad for that person? Well, it might be, but it depends on where the power starts. And Bronfenbrenner is assuming that what has happened is that you have a developing person with a relatively low amount of power, and the other person or the adult, the developer, I guess, he doesn't use that, but we might. The more developed person has the power, and what you're doing is moving it toward greater balance. So it's not that you're giving it all to the developing person, but that you're moving it more toward that perfect relationship, which is an equal balance of power.
So it's like kind of looking at it where one's the teacher, the other's the student, and you're moving towards the mentors.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what Bronfenbrenner is talking about. You're looking at a situation where you have a teacher who has the power, and you're moving toward the mentor relationship or the colleague relationship, where they're doing things together. And many of us have that experience with our teachers, that they gradually give us more and more power and let us take more and more initiative and responsibility in the relationship that we have with them. And when that happens, that's typically a very influential situation, because it's letting you take on gradually the role of the other person, and to, instead of doing what the other person says, which is what we typically do when we come into a class or into a seminar or into a teaching relationship, we follow directions. But as we get more and more skilled, we can begin to decide what the directions are going to be and what the activities are going to be. And you could probably think of lots of examples of that, of thinking of a figure skater that I used to know, who, you know, had the same teacher for years and years. And as she got into competition, he was doing the choreography and teaching her all of the moves, and she was being quite successful at it. And over the course of her high school years, she gradually took on more power in that, and she would veto moves that he wanted to put in, and she would rearrange things, and she would make suggestions, and she ended up, by the time she was in college and still competing, she was doing her own choreographing, but she would take her her routines in development back to him and say, okay, here's what I've got. What do you think? What would you change? How can you make it better? So it had moved, and actually she had, by the time she stopped competing, which she did at the end of college, she had more of the power in their relationship, because she had become very skilled and very knowledgeable. Right. Okay, the question is about up there someplace, probably up above this, it's up above number number two on that, or number one. What characteristics of dyadic interactions affect a person's development? And, excuse me, and the observation is that would be affect, reciprocity, and power. Those are the elements, but then the characteristics of those elements, what's happening in the relationship, would be what you would want to focus on. But once you've got the affect, the power, and the reciprocity to focus on, what you want to think about is where those are. Who has the power? Is it balanced? Is the affect negative or positive? Is it improving or diminishing? Is it becoming more negative? How much reciprocity is there? So you would want to think about changes in the dyadic relationship. And then you have to expand that. Those are the characteristics of the dyadic relationship, but then you have to think about what's going on in that dyadic relationship beyond that. So as you think about what's important in development and think about the other elements, think about molar activities. So what are the activities that are going on in that relationship? Are they joint activities that both people enjoy, that become more complex, that have a higher degree of reciprocity, which it brings you back to the nature of the dyad? What else would you want to look at for the dyadic relationship? What else is likely to make it developmentally good?
The more activities that you do, that vary, the more different activities you do, it's going to make the relationship a lot better because there's going to be a lot more variety. That you're not going to be continuing doing the same thing, going out to dinner and then a movie every single week. It's going to be very boring. Right. So you're going to want to split up, find something more interesting to do.
Right.
So
the variety and complexity of those activities is going to be important. And you don't want to be doing the same thing all the time, because we know that development is enhanced if you are engaged in with people who are engaged in a variety of complex activities. Okay. So you're bringing that element of the nature of the activities that are good for development and asking, are they happening in this dyadic relationship? And what else?
The settings.
Okay. Are you always in the same setting in this dyadic relationship? Or is it a transcontextual dyad? Do those activities happen in different settings? Do you go with this person into different settings? Because the variety and the variety of the settings that you go into and the activities that happen in them is good for your development. And if you're engaged in a transcontextual dyad, then that's increasing it. Okay. What this illustrates is that all these concepts can be pulled together, and that's the way the system works. We've focused on the specific elements, and the expectation sheet and the syllabus focuses on individual elements, but the challenge really is to begin to bring them together to see how they work systemically. They work as a system. So we've got activities, we've got settings. What about roles? You want the person that you're engaging in the dyadic relationship with to occupy a variety of roles. And you want to be able to play different roles within that dyadic relationship. The question is about a role, being placed in a role because of an activity that you're good at, and other people develop relationships with you that are complementary to that role. So you're the math girl in your class, and people create a role for you, the math girl, and you're the one they go to. You're the one they expect to do really well. In it, so nobody else expects to top the class because that's your role. You will do that, and they can count on you to do that, which to some extent lets them off the hook. And they see that role that you're playing getting you into other situations where you're the math girl. You're the one who goes to the math competition. You're the one who is asked to do math in other classes. So this role is being created for you. And then the math starts to get harder for you. So if the circumstances change and the activity becomes more complex, and the expectations of the role change, which is what happens when the math becomes more complex. The expectations for you are rising, and your ability to meet those expectations decreases. Have I got the situation? Then what do you do with that? And what happens, you're suggesting, is that the person gets defensive and starts to cheat. You didn't suggest that. I added that. You've got to stay in the role, because roles are prescriptions for behaviors and relationships. And if you've focused on that particular role and it's a major part of your development and it defines your position in the microsystem, or that pattern of roles, relationships, and activities, math is your activity, the math girl is your role, and your relationships are defined by that, then when you are not able to meet the expectations of that role, that begins to threaten your place in the microsystem, which might make you anxious. And we're going a little bit beyond Bronfenbrenner here, but it's a really nice example of what happens when somebody's role is threatened or they're not able to play it, and how they respond to that, to either try to maintain it, and people could engage in all kinds. I suggested cheating, getting defensive, insisting that you're the math girl even if you're not doing well, trying to hide it, finding excuses for not going to the competition. You know, so you begin to subvert your role and not play it in the appropriate way until it begins to affect your relationships and perhaps your development, because you're not able to carry out that role. So does that make sense? You can think about other examples of that where someone is not able to carry out their role the way they would like to, or the way they're expected to, and it gives you the sense that there's a system here that includes the roles and the activities and the relationships, but your ability to carry out that role is important to define your place in the microsystem. And it may define your mesosystem, your potential mesosystem. If you can't play it, if you can't fulfill it, then what do you do? And I'm thinking, for example, what happens when you lose your breadwinner status and you're the parent and you can't make the world good for your children, or your job is threatened. You worry about your role and therefore your relationships, because you're not able to carry out the role as it's expected. And that creates stress within the family system, because everybody's counting on you to do this and you can't do it. And that the loss of a job, loss of income, has a major impact on people's position within their ecosystem and creates stress as the whole microsystem has to shift to accommodate the change.
Mm-hmm. Then it becomes dangerous. Then there's a position where you want to actually change the expectations. Mm-hmm. You don't want to actually adhere to all these rules.
Right. The observation is that the expectations and the prescription for behavior and relationship associated with a particular role may not be beneficial. They may be pushing people toward activities or relationships that may not be good for their development. And I think that's fairly common. The other part of the observation, as I understand it, is that roles can become stereotypic, and what is expected of a person in the role may not be good for that person's development. And I think that's fairly common, that we get into roles where they're not good for us, and we then have to figure out whether to get out of the role or to change the role. But if you're going to change the role and the expectations for that role, you're, one of Bronfenbrenner's points is that they do prescribe, and if you're not going to follow the prescription, then you're going to be changing the nature of the relationships and the activities in whatever microsystem that role is embedded in. And there will be consequences for that. So you may change it and other people won't accept the change and you get fired. Or you get thrown out of the family, or you get disinherited, or you get thrown in jail because you're not playing the role as people are expecting it. If you are changing the role because you're trying to make it more consistent with a macro system view, I'm translating what you said, that you're trying to make it more consistent with a view of the world, your understanding of it, then you're on the moral high ground, and that would perhaps be good for your development, but it will have repercussions in your ecosystem, and it may affect your relationships. And I'm thinking of several different directions to go with that, and it's a very important point because it suggests what happens in the ecosystem when you try to make the roles consistent or when you try to change the expectations for a particular role. And I'm thinking particularly of if you've taken psychology or human development and studied Kohlberg's notions of moral judgment or any of the stage theories of moral development, one of the issues is that people begin to define their roles and engage in their activities and their relationships to make them consistent with a set of beliefs. And often what happens is that those people are making themselves unwelcome in parts of their former ecosystem. And often they are experiencing consequences in the ecosystem that they may not want, but they are willing to do that because their view of the earth, the world, and their view of their ecosystem is that they're doing the right thing, even though they go to jail, even though they can't be employed in a particular position anymore, even though they're going to lose their elected position, even though their kids are going to tell them they're crazy, even though whatever the consequences are. And what that means is that the person has decided that the belief system, the macro system, that they want to be consistent with requires them to make waves in their ecosystem. And we do those sorts of things because of the depths of our beliefs. And the beliefs are part of what we've developed. They're kind of the end point of development. Development includes the differentiated and valid view of the world you live in and the motivation to maintain it and or change it. Okay, remember that basic, that's where we're going with all this stuff. So when somebody makes that kind of decision, their view of it is that their ecosystem is not, in my case, what I often see is that my ecosystem is not good for the majority of people. And therefore, I'm going to try to change it. And I may be tilting at windmills, but my role is not to fit in the ecosystem that I'm in, but to change the ecosystem that I'm in, because my view of it is that it needs to be changed. It's not being good for other people's development, and maybe not good for mine. That's a very, very important point. That often our roles are not ones that are good for us, and they may not be good for other people. So we we change them. But depending on the nature of the ecosystem you're in, trying to change them, play them differently, may get you in trouble. That's mine. So, to see how the stuff all fits together? And one of the reasons I like Bronfenbrenner, some of you are probably gearing up for the question of why Bronfenbrenner, or why this particular view? And the answer to that is that his is a very general and manageable set of concepts that, from my perspective, apply to everything. I can fit all of my understanding of the world I live in within this relatively simple, may not seem simple to you, but compared to other people's ecological views, this one's relatively simple. And the others are more unwieldy to work with. So this is the one that you start with, this one. After you get really good at this one, I can give you some others to think about and to compare. But from my perspective, they either don't apply across the board, and Bronfenbrenner's is general enough that it does, and I can fit everything in it. Or they may be really, really good. I have to allow that they may be really, really good, and I just don't understand how to use them. So I offer you the one that I do understand how to use and seems useful. But I do have to warn you that there may be better ones out there that I just don't understand. But we'll learn this one, and then you can deal with the others. Other questions? Do you want a couple of examples? Things that would be like what I would put on the exam? Here's a synopsis of a little story. I actually took this from how many of you read 7 Days? Before 7 Days, there was another. There have been two or three. Anyway, I won't bore you with all the details. Anyway, this is based on a real story. And this is what happened. And it was reported in the newspaper. And it's just a simple vignette about somebody's life. So, for those of you who are listening to this, the story is the one about the mother quit her job. I think it's online. Took her two children out of daycare and became a full-time stay-home mom. After a couple of months, she arranged a play group that met one morning a week with children from three other families. The group rotated among the four homes, and the host parents took responsibility for planning and supervising activities. So, what is one dyadic relationship that might be represented in this story? Who's in it? Just one. The mother and each of her children. So there are two dyads there. And presumably the two children were in daycare together, so they had a dyad. So in this case, you would look for the people who have dyadic relationships with each other. And on the eco exam, they would have names. So as you read it, you would say, okay, I can talk about Fred and Alice, and Fred and Charlie, whoever. They would have names, and that would make it easier for you to think of them as a dyad. What happened to her mesosystem? Yeah. Let's take it one step at a time. No, go ahead. Okay, she deleted a setting from her mesosystem. Which one? The job. Assuming that she was working in a setting, she deleted that setting from her ecosystem. She no longer goes there, we'll assume. So she quit her job, which means she probably dropped that setting. Let's say she was an interior designer. Why not? What role change might have happened? She's no longer doing that. Okay, she changed her role from being an employee to being a full-time mother, so that's a role shift. Now she's a... Yeah. She's a host parent when the play group is at her house. She's a visiting parent or participating parent when she's at the other parent's house. Okay. What else has she done to her mesosystem? What are... With, I'm sorry, would the stay-home mother have a relationship with the parents of the other children? Probably, but it's not clear whether she has a relationship with them. It may be telephone. Yes. Yep. You would expect some communication between these settings or among these four settings and making sure that they're safe. It's not clear here whether the other parents come with their children into the host setting or whether they're just dropping them off. So that we'd want to know about that if we were looking at detail. What's happened to her children's mesosystem? Mesosystems, they each have one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Okay. You might want to. Good.
But they also, the mother also added the other.
Right.
The other
family. Right. So the first step was that the children's mesosystem shrank because they're no longer going to daycare. And then, after a couple of months, she's adding three new settings for them, probably less involving and certainly less time in them if it's one morning a week than the daycare. So they're spending presumably more time at home than they did before. So the home setting is more... taking up more time. But the mesosystem has changed in the first place by dropping the daycare setting and in the second place by adding the three other families for the playgroup, the other homes.
So is that expanding it though?
Then it's expanding the number of settings. Then the question would be, is it more richly connected? You know, what's happening here? Another thing that you would want to think about and I would ask specifically about is what's likely to be happening in the home microsystem. So what's happened to that microsystem for these kids? Okay, so they're spending more time at home during the day. Mother is there with them. We hope that their dyadic relationships are improving. Actually, in the story, it was very clear that they had. But that's not clear here. But we hope that she's done this because she wants to spend the time with her kids and she's using that productively. Another way that the home microsystem has changed is that this playgroup comes into it every fourth week. So the microsystem has become a little more varied because the playgroup meets there one morning a week. The jury would be out about whether this is good for their development, but we could look at each of the changes, but particularly what would be of interest is what's happening to their relationship when they're at home. Are they now being hindered in their development because they don't have those 30 kids in the daycare center to interact with? So the number of dyadic relationships is lower for them. But they are spending their time with a very much more developed person with whom they're in a primary dyadic relationship. Are the activities going to be more varied and complex? We don't know that, but those are questions that we would ask. And I think you mentioned the host parent role is being added, or something close to that. So for mom, she has this new role of being the host parent every fourth week. Okay? So you see how that sort of thing works? And when I ask the questions, they will be, the stories are likely to be more specific than this particular one is. Here's one taken from Garbarino's book, from the reading that you had, so you may recognize it. If you're on the web listening, it's the one about Carlton, who's 18 months old. He lives with his father and mother, both of whom feel he was a mistake. Poor Carlton. Okay. So as you look at this particular story, and it's on page 36 in Garbarino's, in the Garbarino reading that you had, I think you had that. Does it look familiar? This may be from the beginning of the next chapter that you didn't have assigned. I think your reading stopped at page 30 or 33. Okay, so you don't have it, but anyway. Here you have a series of dyadic relationships that you could talk about. What's the nature of the dyadic relationship between Carlton and his father? What's the affect? He ignores Carlton except to yell at him. Father feels that Carlton was a mistake. This is probably not a good situation, and it's probably not a happy, positive affect dyadic relationship. What's the relationship between Carlton's mother and father? She blames Carlton and his father. Okay. So there's not much positive there. Molar activities? Not many. Working long hours at a gas station, maybe. Eating dinner, minimal. Watching television, even more minimal. Yelling at Carlton. What's the mother's mesosystem? Doesn't talk about one. Certainly not richly connected. Doesn't talk about family, doesn't talk about friends. She has no friends, so it does talk about them. So she's not going anywhere. She feels trapped and depressed. Yes. Right. Yeah, and what I will do is the examples I use will be more specific than this. So if I'm asking about the nature of the dyadic relationship, there'll be enough information that you can pull it directly. These are both kind of vague, and I'm asking broader questions than will be on the eco exam. If I wanted to make this one more specifically, like the eco exam, identify one setting in the father's meso system. Yeah. Gas station. And I probably wouldn't use this beyond that because it's fairly vague. The ones that I will use have enough detail in them that the questions will be fairly obvious. So identify a setting, identify a dyad. What kind of dyad is it? And you've got it, and you've got enough detail there. Identify a change in a setting. What in the story refers to a macro system? There isn't anything here that does. Yeah, this one, neither of these lend themselves very well to specific objective questions. Okay. But that's the kind of length they will have. And there'll be 6 or 8 pretty straightforward questions for the story. It's just, you know, can you identify the elements? Can you figure out where there's a role? Can you figure out where the meso system is?
Will there be, like, what's the meso system, what's the role, or do we have?
It would be something more like identify two roles. So you just name them, you know, housekeeper, father, kid, whatever is in the story. I haven't picked or written the story for Monday yet, so I don't know what do. It might be something as vague as what in the story refers to the macro system. And I'll just quote one from the earlier story in the in the original story, the mother is quoted as saying that in other countries, in European countries that she's familiar with, parents are encouraged to stay home with their young children, and they are supported financially for doing that. So she's complaining about the United States, so she's had to take a cut in her income. Fortunately, her husband can provide enough for the family if they cut back. And that's part of the story, is about what it takes to provide your own child care as a stay-home mom, and the problems with that and the conflict for her as a woman, an educated woman, in doing that. But her reasons for doing it. But in the story, there's one line that refers to what happens in other countries where they support parents staying home with their own children. That would refer to the macro system. Because it's a different culture that has a different system and different expectations and different beliefs about parents staying home with their kids. So you would go through, if I asked you to identify what in the story refers to the macro system, you would pick that out and say her comment about European countries would refer to the macro system. Yes. No, I will not ask a question specifically about the difference between effect and affect. Was that what you asked? No, I won't do that. That was just my bugaboo for the year. I did the same exercise in my senior class in family systems, and 9 out of the 25 made at least one mistake. So it may be hopeless. You do need to be clear about how to use affect and affect and effect and effect, but you'll get used to it. I won't ask you because it's not a part of Bronfenbrenner's scheme. It's just my brain burp for the year. And we don't take off for spelling either. Yes. There's matching short answer. Basically true false, picking the characteristics that are likely to be good for development. Characteristics of a mesosystem. There's a list, things like that. So it's all very, not much writing, and lots of put an X in the appropriate spot.
So we'll have to distinguish a lot between like the mesosystem, microsystem.
Yep. You have to distinguish carefully between mesosystem, microsystem, macrosystem, exosystem. Yeah. So that's a major part of it. To make sure that you've got those clear and well differentiated so that you can talk about microsystem and talk about the patterns happening in a specific setting and know that when you're talking about a microsystem, you're not talking about the relationships between settings. Because that would be mesosystem. But when you talk about the mesosystem, you need to be talking about the relationships between the settings that the person is engaged in. But it's really just sort of checking to see if you've got the vocabulary and the grammar of Bronfenbrenner's scheme and can apply it when you see it. You ready to go play in the snow? Okay, have a great weekend. And I'll see you here on Monday.